So this is the Half Moon One Pra Monday night, and first night officially off of our winter retreat, having concluded that yesterday, a trip to the coast for a bit of an outing. And Lumpa, Jnanako, several other members of the community have gone away for a few days. Fair amount of activity for a few of us today, too. It kind of hit the ground running with the annual meetings of our monastic foundation. Alms round this morning, of course, and then a sizable town trip this afternoon with three of us going to doctor's appointments and different kinds of things. Getting back a little bit late in the afternoon. So it's off and running in Ubayagiri. And just a lot of stimulation after a retreat. It has a certain impact in the mind, and it's not unpleasant, it's just impactful. So there's a fair amount of certain kinds of energy that kind of get lodged from a day like this, and then also the benefit of having practiced for 3 months and sharpening the tools of knowing and letting go so that the recovery process is not so bad. It's actually quite okay. But my mind was kind of feeling a little bit weary and kind of maybe a bit unsure of what to talk about tonight after these 3 months of winter retreat. I thought something I almost never do. In fact, I'm not sure. Maybe I've done it once before in my monastic career, but thought I'd actually just start with a fairly short sutta that's always been a wonderful, special one in my memory, and then maybe just make a few comments on that rather than a completely off the top of the head kind of Dhamma talk. So the sutta that I was thinking might be nice to read out and share is a one that probably almost all of you, if not all of you, are familiar with. it's called the Bhadekarata Sutta, A Single Excellent Night, in this translation. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya, number 131. So nothing like the direct words of the Buddha to maybe give a little bit of inspiration for the evening. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, I shall teach you the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this, "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night." So after that, wonderful verse, the Buddha talks a little bit more. How, bhikkhus, does one revive the past? One nurtures delight there, thinking, I had such material form in the past. One nurtures delight there, thinking, I had such feeling in the past. I had such perception in the past. I had such formations in the past. I had such consciousness in the past. That is how one revives the past. And how, bhikkhus, does one not revive the past? One does not nurture delight there, thinking, I had such material form in the past. One does not nurture delight there, thinking, I had such feeling in the past. I had such perceptions in the past. I had such formations in the past. I had such consciousness in the past. That is how one does not revive the past. And how, bhikkhus, does one build up hope upon the future? One nurtures delight there, thinking, may I have such material form in the future? One nurtures delight there, thinking, may I have such feeling in the future? May I have such perception in the future? May I have such formations in the future? May I have such consciousness in the future? That is how one builds up hope upon the future. And how, bhikkhus, does one not build up hope upon the future? One does not nurture delight there, thinking, may I have such material form in the future? One does not nurture delight there, thinking, may I have such feeling in the future? May I have such perception in the future? May I have such formations in the future? May I have such consciousness in the future? That is how one does not build up hope upon the future. And how, bhikkhus, is one vanquished in regard to presently arisen states? Here, bhikkhus, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or as self in material form. He regards feeling as self, perception as self, formations as self, consciousness as self, or self as possessed of consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. This is how one is vanquished in regard to presently arisen states. And how, bhikkhus, is one invincible in regard to presently arisen states? Here, bhikkhus, a well-taught noble disciple, who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, does not regard material form as self, or self as possessed of material form as in self, or self as in material form. He does not regard feelings as self, perception as self, formations as self, consciousness as self, or self as possessed of consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. That is how one is invincible in regard to presently arisen states. Let not a person revive the past, or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night. So it was with reference to this that this was said. Bhikkhus, I shall teach you the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So a very lovely teaching. Number of different kinds of layers, but often the ones that I have thought about in regards to this sutta are the fruitlessness of dwelling in the past, dwelling in the future, and being confused in the present. And the Buddha's very direct instructions not to do it that way. You know, in so many of the Buddha's teachings, he has so many different approaches to the teachings on not self, and this is another one of the ways he kind of, you know, grabs our attention with the context of not getting lost in past and present and future realities through the contemplation and development of that perception of not self in relation to any of the five khandhas. Over and over again, he does it relentlessly, trying to remind us not to just get, not to buy into these five khandhas, forms, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness as who we are, or in any way related to a sense of me or mine. And he does it so many different ways over and over again. It makes me feel pleased and happy, because I was talking with Longpa the other day. I said, you know, I'm just, after giving talks, what seems like a lot of them over a number of years, I just find like I keep on repeating myself over and over again, and people must be getting bored. And he said, oh, well, you know, Buddha, we all do this, you know, we all say the same thing over and over again as when we're asked to reflect on Dhamma. The Buddha, you know, did it too. You know, how many times did he repeat the same things over and over again in different, trying to do it in different ways, in different situations, but essentially the same messages coming in? And it's because people need to hear it many times to actually let it sink in. So the fact that he constantly expounds on the not-self from different angles, emphasizes the importance of it and the centrality to that reflection and understanding, to realizing some sort of freedom in our hearts and our minds. You know, there's a lot of different angles that he uses to get us to contemplate in this way, and just even in the basic introduction to the teaching with the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, you know, he approaches it from different angles. The angle of suffering, the angle of impermanence, contemplating those aspects of our experience, with the moving in the direction of realizing an understanding of not self, everything that's impermanent and is unsatisfactory, how can one regard it as self? There's the other aspect, the other approach he uses in that particular sutta is the approach of uncontrollability, which I think is a really important aspect, and I find myself using that as a very active contemplation in meditation, and just as experience comes through my mind, through my heart, on a regular basis, using that contemplation of uncontrollability as a basic refuge, really. You know, how often we get caught in this feeling that things, I should have control over things, there's some way that when unpleasant experience comes across my plate, I get absorbed or entangled, fascinated with, that it shouldn't be there, that if only I were a different person, or I had more skills, or I hadn't done such stupid things in the past, and I really need to not do stupid things in the future, and you know, all the words that we can use that are reflective of this sense of wanting to try and control, and feeling like we should have control over our body, our feelings, our perceptions, our thoughts, our and even the basic experience of conscious awareness, that impulse, that deep move in the heart to try and have control over it. A personal control. And then I won't have to suffer anymore. And how we have to learn how relentless that pursuit is over and over and over again before we can relinquish that pattern. So over and over again, Buddha says, contemplate these five khandhas and see if how we view them, how we use them, how we relate to them is indeed really true. So to think about things, the body is the best place, of course, as always, to start. It's tangible, it's here and now. If we don't get too involved with it, it pretty much has its own life, it does its own thing. Illness comes, aging comes, death comes. We can all experience those to some extent or another and contemplate them if we aren't experiencing them right here and now. And just to see the impossibility of having this kind of absolute control. I didn't have any say in the fact that the vertebrae in my neck are starting to degenerate according to the MRI and causing certain kinds of pain that probably won't ever go away. I was in with our nurse practitioner this afternoon and I said my main goal is just to see if I can stem the deterioration. And I said, what do you think? Is the prognosis just kind of one of a gradual decline? And he said, yep. So, okay, right, get used to it, Karuna Damo. We just don't, we don't have control over the inevitability of this body or the other things. I lost my hearing temporarily a while back and, it's okay now that these things are going to be happening more and more. No control, no say in it. It's all happening. And I'm relatively lucky, other people have to experience much more severe challenges. And eventually all of us will in some way or another. So to really let that sink in over and over, and it just takes constant repetition of contemplation, but to be able to really and quite with a sense of almost relief to realize I don't have to control it. Since I can't anyway, how actually pleasing it is to not have to feel obligated in any way, that it's not right, that it's not the way it should, that it's not the way it should be. It's perfectly fine because it's nature. It's the law of nature. It's not pleasant, and I wouldn't mind if it happened in different ways. But who has the control over that? It just really isn't, and this is the living example of it. So we need to take these opportunities to really let that sink in and turn what often can result in this kind of grasping and protesting and attachment to what's happening and just see it as it happens in this very moment and be okay with it. The feelings of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral and the transiency of those and the uncontrollability. I mean, any kind of contact we have with the outside world or with the inside world, our mental world, there's going to be some sort of feeling tone with that. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's not pleasant at all. Sometimes it's just confusing, anxiety-producing, fear-causing. There's really no control over that. How we respond to it is something that we have a modicum of control over. That's where we can develop habits, and that's where we don't have to suffer as in our response. Because, as you know, most people know, I think all those feelings have their underlying tendencies. The feeling of whenever there's something pleasant, we go for it. We want to hold on to it. And whenever it's something unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. We want to annihilate it. When it's just confusing and we don't know what's going on, or we're just not paying attention, the tendency is to just be ignorant of it, not know it, and not be aware of what's going on. All states of dukkha, really. And do we wish that on ourselves? You know, when unpleasant feeling comes, how often do we get involved in resistance and trying to correct it and trying to escape it and trying to make it not be? And how that can be just turned by saying, totally out of control. You know, it's just inherent in life that any kind of contact with the sensory world or the mind, it's going to be one of those three experiences. I don't have anything to do with it. Perceptions, those, you know, patterns that are, you know, ingrained in us through repetition, through habit, that are often unpleasant. Memories are part of perceptions, you know, and how often, you know, sometimes, particularly, of course, when we're trying to sit still and have a nice, quiet, peaceful meditation and let go of the concerns of the day or of the week, or this period of time. How often do memories pop up, the past? And how often do we go to them and say, you know, oh, if only it had been this way? Or going to the future of, oh, the next time that happens, I don't want it to be the way it happened. I need to figure out how not to make that happen. Going to the past, going to the future, and being confused about how to deal with the memory in the present, just being overwhelmed, say, by a negative memory that just keeps popping up. And feeling like we should be able to do something. But if we can just regard it as uncontrollable, this memory has popped up, it's an event that I'm experiencing over again in my mind. I really don't have any control over the fact that it's arisen in the present moment, this memory of the past, this, you know, pattern that we want to not experience. Thoughts are unwieldy sometimes, the sankhara. You know, we can get, you know, I think most of us in some way or another, whether it's a, you know, actual clinical obsessiveness or just general, you know, everyday human obsessiveness, we get caught up in the thought realm. Thoughts take over, they proliferate, we get into papancha, we keep on reinforcing these patterns of thinking that are quite unpleasant sometimes, and we think we need to get control over them, that there's something that I need to do to annihilate this pattern. I want to get rid of it because it's unpleasant. I don't want anything to do with it. Why me? Here it comes. Oh no, here it comes again. And how to be able to say, no control. Here it comes. Okay. What? How do I respond? If I respond with that kind of, oh no, here it comes again, then how much does that just add on to the layer of suffering? Easier to just to say, here it comes. Okay, I'll be with it. Consciousness, the mind that constantly darts from one sense base to the other, often landing in some sort of proliferative thought process again in the mind, but awareness of sights and sounds and tastes, tactile sensations, smells, and how the mind just constantly moves from one to another based on the underlying tendencies, the anusaya that are pulling the attention to a different sense base over and over again, weaving this illusion of a continuous reality. And really, how much control do we have over that? That it's a process that we've become habituated to based on causes and conditions. So, you know, the old kind of probably over-repeated the saying of, you know, relax, everything's out of control. Is to keep on bringing that to mind. It's, we don't need to spin ourselves out trying to balance the ship and make us all, you know, make it all perfect and pristine. We just need to get used to the fact that we don't really have that kind of ultimate control. Which doesn't mean that we don't take any kind of responsibility for anything that happens in our life. It's not the kind of, you know, what they call crazy wisdom thing where, oh, okay, well, nothing matters because it is all out of control. So just kind of jump on and enjoy the ride when the pleasant times come and not take any kind of responsibility for karma and the results of karma. Because even if it's not self, you know, if there is no one who is in absolute control, which is absolutely true, our underlying tendencies, the greed, hatred, and delusion, and all the confusion, are still, they're the ones that are taking control and causing us to respond in certain ways, body, speech, mind, and when they're in control and doing their thing, then our suffering just compounds. So even though it's not self, if we don't want to suffer, then we need to figure out a way to hold it as not who I am, but just as establishing an intention for more skillful patterns so that we don't cause damage to ourselves or to others, and we don't keep getting lost in the illusion of trying to take control. When we can't. And all of that is done through mindfully remembering to consciously encourage skillful ways of holding it all and how not to reinforce those patterns through inappropriate attention. And the basic underlying quality of mind that we need to nurture, to hold all of this, is that sense of patience, spacious kindness, acceptance, and wisdom to really be with it in the present moment, not entangling ourselves, consciously letting it be completely known, completely felt, completely experienced, and held in such an open, wide space that it can also be relinquished, not pushed away, but held lightly, not clung to, but held in just this momentary awareness of the full experience, fully understanding dukkha, the first noble truth, full understanding. And the developing that skill is what allows us to release, not to hold. So there's really no control in a sense of how past karma, past conditioning comes to manifest in any one moment of experience. That is out of control. It's a process that has been set in motion and has results. And it is completely within our ability to develop, just by remembering over and over again, to stop and look clearly, to allow it, to not resist it, to just be aware of that sense of wanting to rise up and resist the unpleasant, and to say, okay, it hasn't ever worked before, so, you know, don't go there. And you know, developing that as a skill, and just watching how, as that skill develops, the process of release and relinquishment just slowly, slowly, slowly becomes more of the innate response, the conditioned response. We condition ourselves to be alert, to be aware, to recognize, and not to take it all so personally, not to take it so seriously, not to take it as who I am and try and control it. It's the result of all the conditions in the past that have been set in motion, not who I am. And I need to know it and let it be, not act on it, not create any more dukkha around it, not reinforce the patterns. And the more you do that, the more light the world becomes. It doesn't necessarily, you can't do it with thinking, okay, I'll do this and then it'll go away. You know, these patterns, some of them may gradually kind of efface themselves and whittle away and become less prominent. Some of them may just stay around for at least the rest of this life. And we can't enter into the practice thinking, you know, a bargain in the mind. You know, it's like, if I do this practice, then I won't have to experience unpleasantness anymore. It doesn't work that way. That's a setup too. So being comfortable with patterns that are deeply embedded and not feeling obligated to be perfect, or not feeling obligated to, you know, not be neurotic a little bit. It's okay. But we learn how to hold it and not to inflict it on others if possible too. Because it's, you know, it's just following its own course of nature. Just as the body gets old, sick, we can't control it in that way. Sometimes the mental patterns, even the ones that are embedded fairly heavily, sometimes, you know, we may not be able to not experience those at some point, but we learn how to be with them and hold them and not buy into them as who we are.
And that's where suffering ends.
So just thinking about, you know, the sutta, not trying to recreate the past or create the future in regard to the five khandhas, in regards to how we regard them in any way whatsoever as ourself, looking at it from this angle of lack of absolute control, but also realizing that we do have the ability to be with the five khandhas in a very wise way, where we don't get entangled in their stories. And that doing that, just as a repetitive practice over and over again, is one of the major paths that the Buddha taught us of how we can experience freedom. So I will leave it there for tonight.